All right, what are we? What are you making?
I am I'm making a hotel old fashioned with some blackjack, which is going to be interesting because that's a piece of shit whiskey. But we're going to do it. So basically, I always do my old fashions with the inside of an orange, so a half peel, and then the round inside, and then a little bit of sugar, and then two or three dashes of bitters, and then I mash that at the bottom of the glass, and I'll pour the whiskey over that, and then usually roll it with some ice, and then top it with some soda, and then an orange peel. Could add a little bit of cherry juice, but we don't have any cherries, so fuck it. Do you want more?
No. No. I mean...
Because I'm not doing this again, so once we mix it, we're mixing it.
No, no, you've told me for 2 days what a crap-ass whiskey this is, so I'm fully prepared to go light.
To be clear, you picked this off the shelf. I pointed it out and told you what it was, and you were like, yeah, we're going to fucking do it.
That is actually what my voice sounds like when I'm off mic.
Yeah, we're going to fucking do it.
Nathan just turned into a frat bro right away.
Let's do it, bro.
You are the host of a drinking podcast, so...
That is true.
That's fair.
Let me interrupt this Iraq happy hour with a quick but important rule of doing journalism overseas, something the legendary correspondent wrangler Howard Chua Earn taught me early in my time at Time Magazine. The rule? Know who you're going in with. That could be a well-connected contact, a wary and smart fellow journalist, an expensive but worth it fixer. These are the kind of people who'll make your reporting better, more truthful, and safer. For me, for Iraq, Genghis Yar is the person I'm going in with. I've worked with Genghis for years. He was most recently the managing editor at Roads and Kingdoms, but he's also put a lot of time in this country, from Kirkuk to Mosul to Baghdad, but especially here in Erbil, in Kurdistan, in Iraq's north. So when we started talking about bringing the Trip podcast to Iraq, there was no question I would go when Genghis was there, and I wanted him on the show. He is, to me, the platonic ideal of what a photojournalist should be. Compassionate, intelligent, he's got a great eye, but he's not in love with the aesthetics of the work. He's brave without being stupid, and he makes a very, very good drinking partner. Over the next 4 weeks, this show is going to be in Iraq. Why here? It's not known for its drinking culture, especially. Definitely not during Ramadan, which is when I was there. But I had lots of reasons for coming here. One, I actually like tea, and the Kurds are tea fiends. Two, I knew I would find some very intense, very funny, very smart people to talk to here. Three, I like boiled sheep, and you can't get that just anywhere. And four, I think every American should come to Iraq. It's like when your dog pees on the floor and you actually have to show the spot to the dog when you're scolding it. Otherwise, they just forget or they don't even understand what they fucked up in the first place. We Americans have been peeing all over the world for most of my adult life, and somehow our government wants to add to it with Iran, just a little over 100 miles from where I've recorded these episodes. Forget Spring Break Daytona or backpacking through Europe. The real travel experience for Americans should be to go see those places that we lit on fire. It should be like a mandatory aliyah for any would-be neocons. Come visit. Stay in a marginal hotel like my $30 a night Hotel Farik. Drink and talk with locals. And really start to understand how little you actually know the place, and yet how much you're starting to like it. It would take all the fun out of nation building and foreign policy floor peeing. Just saying. I am Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, this is The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
Got some old fashions. You said you make the best old fashions.
Yeah.
You said that. This is a really good old fashioned, I have to say. The best, is that like a Erbil-wide or a Kurdistan-wide or Middle East conflict journalist-wide? Like, who are you beating in this best old fashioned?
Well, I would say I definitely make the best old fashioned in Kurdistan that I've ever had. And among my friend group, I don't know another journalist that has... hung out in my circles, I guess, that mixed cocktails for their friends after
after a day of war reporting. But I'd say like this old fashioned is what I learned to make in Chicago, busting my ass behind a bar, and routinely got told this was the best old fashioned that people had. So based on like John and Jim and Susie's recommendation in a bar in Chicago, this is the best old fashioned, which I've taken with me. So
right. So little did the foreign correspondent press corps know, and the Iraqi fixers and local journalists, they didn't know what was coming.
No.
When you came from Chicago to come cover the conflict in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere.
But
you were bringing a really strong old-fashioned game.
A really strong old-fashioned game, but also a really strong margarita game, which was a hit.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That was the margaritas really, really set the tone for what cocktails could be. I had requests on a pretty frequent basis for cocktail nights, which were mainly just margarita nights, and I would often cook burgers as well.
Okay.
So
Jesus. So you were bringing the full Buffett.
Yeah. Yeah.
Full Jimmy Buffett. I like to
host. I love to host. So yeah. Having people over and cooking and socializing is a lot of fun.
You know, it's funny because like these are delightful skills and we're kind of joking around about them, but it's just always amazing to me. You know, we bitch a lot about journalists and people who are rude and, you know, just untoward and set a bad reputation for themselves. It still happens. It's kind of shocking to me because it is such a small community. And I feel like we're on the verge of some really great advice for the kids out there. It's just like, take care of, you know, be good. Like, be the guy who makes a drink for somebody at the end of the day.
Just take care of your people.
Yeah.
Like, don't be a fucking asshole. That's the core for traveling internationally. That's the core for reporting internationally. That's the core for walking down your fucking street.
That's like, right. These are not specific journalism skills.
Like, you just have to be a good person.
Yeah.
And like, you'll make it.
I mean, you say walking down the street, but by the way, this old fashioned is really delicious.
I know.
I'm about halfway through already and it's refreshing and fantastic.
You can make yourself another one. That was a lot of work with that butter knife.
I wouldn't even know where to begin. I'm going to let you continue to take care of me here in Iraq, or we'll just move to straight blackjack. But no, I mean, it's like there is something that is particular to journalism, which is in, you know, this is a small community. I mean, just straight up, like there's even with people cycling through, even with, you know, the kind of the more transient nature. How many foreign journalists have come through in your years in Kurdistan? Would have been 30, 40?
No, you know? No, like way more than that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, especially through the battle for Mosul, like you had TV crews coming through and, you know, every reporter who wanted to do international war reporting came through. So it was actually a lot.
Well, TV is different. Those guys are dicks.
Yeah. I mean, fuck TV. That's in general.
Yeah. We're
but also TV journalism. Like
we're print guys. Here I am talking about being nice to everybody. I'm like, fuck those guys.
But yeah, like there were lots of people that came through here, but enough where the circle is still really small. So talking like a couple hundred people,
yeah.
And you know, under 100 that stayed for a long duration, and then like under 50 who were here for most of the fighting, and then way, way fewer that have stayed for, you know, a year or plus. And then a really small amount that have, you know, made this their home.
Yeah.
Well, as far as like international reporters go,
I you know, as we were talking about, while you were making the drinks, there is a light urine scent in this hotel room. Just reminds me of that expression, don't shit the bed. You know, like, you are in a very small group, relatively, whether it's, you know, a few dozen or a couple hundred even, of people who will talk about you and will know how you treat people and how you treat yourself. And it's, you know, the kind of bad behavior that we've seen time and again is very strange. And it's one of the things that always attracted me to you as a person and the work that you did. Was it wasn't just the photography, but it was a sense, it's like, everybody loves Genghis.
Well, I'm totally not sure about that. I could probably guess that there's people that talk shit about me on a regular basis, but I think I've tried my best to take care of a lot of people and just be good. I don't think you need to put that much effort into life just to look out for others. And I don't know, that's been my mantra here, more or less, is just try to establish a sense of community and a home for the people that did work here, for the journalists and fixers and anybody else we, you know, interacted with. It was just, let's establish like a sense of community and a sense of home. And and create some base that we can all take care of each other, because especially in the freelance community, there's no one looking out for you. There's not a single person that's going to like have your back if you're doing this on your own. So we needed that. Like, we needed some sort of stability, and I hope that I was able to provide that for a few people in the very least. And, you know, if that was running to a hospital to check on some kid I've never heard of, I did that, you know. And if it was running to a hospital to check on my friend, like, I did that. And, like, that's I wanted other people to do that too, and kind of, like, instill that mantra in the community that we have here. Stepping away from Iraq felt like I was losing a lot of that too, because I was stepping away from that community that I had built for myself and, you know, my friends built around me. That kind of sucked. Leaving a friend group that was so close because of that sense of needing to be there for one another in case shit went down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not something that you get to experience a lot in civilian life in the States, no matter how mission-driven.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting bluehost.com. That's bluehost.com.
So, well, let's get into that, man. How did you get from where you started to where we are now, Erbil, for as long as you were here?
I was doing a big project on Syrian refugees in 2014. So my idea was to create a portraiture of Syrian refugees that gave a more just like personal and sensitive look at kids. So what does a Syrian refugee kid look like? What do they think? What do they want? What do they like doing? And just like, who are they? And present that to an American audience in the hopes of trying to convince them that these people matter, and Syrian refugees matter, and they shouldn't be looked at like however American audiences look at Syrian refugees.
And why kids? I mean, you don't have children. You, at that point, were in your 20s. It's like the valley in terms of kid connectivity for most people. Like, why did you decide that those would be the subjects of this like huge project that you're going to take on?
Well, I mean, personally, I don't know. I love children. I love the innocence of children everywhere. And just, I always personally connect and like relate to kids in a very, you know, emotional way. And I wanted to try to communicate that sympathy I felt for Syrian refugees and try to pull that out of an American audience. And I thought if I can present them as I see them, maybe that would connect with somebody else. So doing that through Polaroids, which is what the whole project was based around, was, you know, Polaroid camera, instant photography. And trying to make everybody knows what a Polaroid looks like, beyond just the fact that it's like an original, like you can't ever replicate a Polaroid, just like you can't ever replicate a child. Everybody knows what a Polaroid looks like, and it's like, it's relatable to a wide American audience, and just to use that as the medium to try to make a connection was the general idea. So the whole project was, you know, all four countries that surrounded Syria, which also had the largest Syrian refugee populations. So that was Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. And I would go to those countries and I would talk to children and their families and just present them in a not political way. Just like, who are these people? Like, who are these kids? And, you know, what's their favorite color? What's their favorite food? And try to bring that back and make a connection. And that's the first time I came to Kurdistan and experienced Iraq.
But you hadn't worked at all in the Middle East before.
No, I had. So I came here in 2012, not to Iraq. I came to the Middle East in 2012 and did Syria. First experience in the Middle East was 2012 into Aleppo with the Free Syrian Army.
And that was a more conventional, like, just straight up foreign correspondent. I'm going in with the combatants and we'll try to shoot near the action.
Yeah, that was much more straightforward, like, let's, you know, do straight up journalism, like straight up photojournalism, and try to communicate that. And I mean, I did a weird project there too, where I photographed young Syrian fighters, you know, 17, 18, 19 year old guys, and asked them, you know, why they're fighting. And, you know, who are you? Why are you fighting? How old are you? Like, where are you from? What did you do before this? And just those normal questions that I think correspondents kind of miss. You know, that's not a news peg. No one's like, oh, like, who are these people? Like, but like, I...
What did they study?
Well, yeah. And right. Like, but I think that's important. Like,
right.
I think it's important, like, what Ahmed studied and, like, why he picked up a gun and, you know, what happened to his family, and try to present that in a portraiture series. So that was, like... outside of the straight photojournalism, that was one of the first projects I did in the Middle East. And, you know, it was terrible. It was really shitty. Like, I wasn't a good photographer in 2012, and I've grown a lot since then. But that was my first attempt working in the region. And then in 2014, tried to, like, expand on that with, like, a child push. Guys with guns don't relate really well to, well, maybe they do, but...
I mean, almost too well sometimes. Well,
like,
right?
Middle Eastern guy holding a gun and, yeah, like, trying to make that person relatable is, like, a little harder than, like, a kid on a swing set, more or less.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's that classic conflict that we have in journalism where it's like people understand that image of a Middle Eastern guy with a gun in a way that's probably not what you want to have happen, you know, or that is useful to the conversation at all, because they're just going to be like, oh, well, this is a place where everybody's always just shot at each other, you know, which is actually very far from the truth. And one of the things that even now, however many years, Jesus Christ, we're like, you know, 15 years after the invasion of Iraq, there multiple Iraqis have felt it necessary to remind me that Iraq is a rich and educated country. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, they have a self-image that they know from, you know, long and hard experience is not the image that is presented in the West, in the places where decisions are being made about their lives, right? They're like, listen, we have other dreams besides, you know, defeating ISIS. Like, that's not the plan. Like, the plan is something beyond that. So it's kind of that, you know, I don't recall having seen your pictures from 2012 in that project. I'll take your word that they were shitty pictures, but that instinct of trying to push through some of those prejudices or those stereotypes about who these people are and why they're fighting and, you know, how inevitable it was that they'd be fighting. Those are great instincts.
I don't know why it is, but I think probably it has something to do with the fact that, like, I didn't go to journalism school. I never set out to be, like, some foreign correspondent. Like, I somehow, down my roads of traveling, like, started wanting to tell stories and tell stories with pictures and trying to figure out a way to make people relatable and to make people care about the world around them. And I thought one of the ways to do that was by just presenting people as they are, which I wasn't seeing anywhere else. You know, I grew up on a diet of Fox News, like, and that was my whole idea growing up of what journalism was. And when I started taking pictures of other people and being able to share their stories to an audience back home, like, the most obvious thing to me was just, like, present them as they are. Present people as I would present my brother to someone else, or I would hope, like, they would, some other person, some foreigner in my country would present my family to their audience. And I don't know, I always carried that with me.
Yeah, that's funny. My son, who's in fifth grade now, had just... they'd had some kind of section in their class about journalism where there was a curriculum based around, like, what is journalism? And, you know, he kind of ran me through a couple of things they were telling me. He's like, does that sound right? And, you know, I immediately became, like, kind of crotchety old newsman. It was like, you don't need rules. Like, all you need is a pen and a conscience, you know, like, that's what journalism is. And, you know, he's kind of like, but it had nothing to do with the question he had actually asked me. But I'll say that, like, 1,000 times, too. It's like, you don't need that education. You just need to have the mentality of trying to tell people stories in a compassionate way. And then, you know, being smart enough, emotionally smart enough to sort of figure out, like, you know, like what the power dynamic is and how people back home are going to receive this and how you can fight, you know, this unending struggle that we all have against compassion fatigue and stereotyping. So fuck, you know, higher education and journalism, like, unless you, you know, badly need a structure for your career change, there's nothing that they can teach you that you wouldn't know as a human who can go out and experience and make mistakes and just try to be better at telling those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say, like, I told everybody's story to the fullest extent that, like, I don't just... I didn't do a good job with everybody's story, and that upsets me. Like, and I do wish I had some sort of formal education earlier on in my career.
It might have helped, but it definitely might not have helped. I mean, I've seen a lot of people with formal education who just make weird and bad decisions because they're weird and bad people. Like, you just can't, yeah. You can't educate or, like, degree yourself away from that. I wanted to ask you also something. I mean, you're unusual in the sense, I mean, you had described your upbringing like you were, you know, born and raised in New Jersey. Well, you weren't born in New Jersey, but you were raised in New Jersey.
Right? I was born in, you born were, in Jersey.
Jesus, yeah. Christ. This is more serious than I thought.
Yeah, I know. I've got all of that baggage with me, which I've carried around for my entire life.
You were raised on a diet of Fox News, as you said. You have your father's name.
I do.
You were a junior. Your name is like, you know, baroquely, you know, kind of ornately Turkish. It's Cengiz Yar.
Junior.
I'm sure that you've had to deal with that in America in different ways your entire life. But now you've come to a region where Turkishness, like Turkish identity is, and certainly Turkish politics and military power is like a huge player in the daily lives of all of these stories that you're telling. I find it kind of fascinating that you ended up here. I mean, is that part of the gravitational pull?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's like a weird thing in me where it feels right being in the Middle East. And I don't know how to explain that. But the first time I landed in Turkey, it was strange, like seeing my name on buildings and, you know, everybody else looked like me. Like, I grew up in a super, super white neighborhood in Jersey. Like, super white, like part of the country where my friends all had pickup trucks with shotguns. Like, it was not the Jersey most people think of. It was rural fucking Jersey. And I was the only kid in eighth grade who had hair on his arms and was way darker than every other kid in my class. And I wouldn't say that was something I realized when I was in the eighth grade, but it was definitely something that played a factor in, like, oh, like, everybody else here doesn't really look like me. I wouldn't say they, like, picked on me any more than anybody else, like, because in eighth grade, like, everybody kind of gets picked on. But, yeah, you know, you make that subconscious, like, check mark where you're like, oh, I'm a little bit different than everybody. And then, like, landing in Turkey, it was like, oh, fuck, I look like everybody else in this country. And, like, everybody recognizes my name. And this is, like, really weird where, like, I'll go to a truck stop and there's, like, you know, all the coffee cups and my name's on the coffee cup. Whereas, like, driving through Illinois, my name's not on any fucking coffee cup.
That is true.
I'm not saying that, like, that, you know, that's a calculation in, like, being in the Middle East, but maybe it was, maybe it is. And I think, like, I feel a little bit relatable to just, like, identity here and, like, who I am as a person and where my father came from and, you know, what it means to be a Turkish American. And, yeah, like, just on a name basis, like, everybody knows a Cengiz. Like, everybody knows how to pronounce it. Everyone knows, like, what it looks like. And everybody claims it as their own, too. So it's like the Kurds will claim Cengiz. Like, the Syrian Kurds will claim Cengiz. Syrians will claim it. Like, Turks claim it. And they're like, oh, you know, your father must have been mistaken. He was probably a Kurd. Like, well, pretty sure he was Turkish. But like Arabs will say I look Arab, and you know, there's just like this weird mixed identity with like my mixed heritage in the States that translates to me fitting in communities here really easily. I think as a photographer, maybe my looks do help a little bit because I'm able to blend in. That, like, you know, that challenge of photographers just being able to seep away into the background, that like cliche of like being a fly on the wall, which, you know, I do try to be very often. It's just like be present, be there, but not be noticed. Not standing out fucking helps with that. And, you know, not being a very different looking person in a situation really does help with that. And, you know, I think I work around that in different ways when I'm working in areas where I don't look like everybody. And I know photographers here that don't look like everybody here that work around that too. But I think I've been at some advantage in some situations where I just no one notices me because I look like just everybody else.
So you're working on Serious Children as a project, which was this four nation look at how the children of, you know, who were affected by the war saw themselves and through Polaroids. How did that get you up here and why did you stay in northern Iraq?
Well, so in 2014, Iraq had a Syrian refugee population of like almost 320,000 people. And those were mainly Syrian Kurds who were fleeing the fighting and the economic disparity that the fighting was causing, and just were more or less like most of them were economic refugees, but they were living in camps around Kurdish held Iraq. And part of my goal was to stop and meet them and use the project to tell their stories. And that's what I did. So I took a bus from Diyarbakir across the border and got into Erbil at like 1 o'clock at night and had some local connections and, you know, started the project here. And I'd never been to Iraq before. I'd never been to Kurdistan before and didn't know much about the country besides what I had seen on the news and growing up. And I thought I should be afraid, you know, just as an American, most of the perception about Iraq is just to be afraid.
Fear Kurds as well, right?
Like, I'd read about Kurds and I've heard about them from friends, and I never met a Kurd before. And, you know, quickly upon being in the region for, you know, a couple of days, it was almost like my mind was almost blown. It's like, oh, this is what Iraq is, and this is what Kurdistan is, and separate from Iraq, and all of these like weird things that I never thought about kind of were just like opening my eyes for me. And there weren't that many people here, and everybody I met was really friendly, and it was like, you know, this place is super interesting, and I want to learn more about it, and I want to keep photographing it, and I want to come back here. So I left, and I finished the project, went to Jordan, and then Lebanon, and then went home. And it was kind of like always in my mind, like, I really want to come back to Kurdistan. Like, I really want to experience more of the country and learn more about it and learn more about Iraq through it. And it seems like an easy place to be because you can just land with American passport and live safely. And there were people here I knew by that point. So I tried over the next year. It was just like, I'm going to figure out a way to get back there. And at some point I made the calculation. I was like, I'm going to do that. And I don't know when that was, but it was like, ever since I got back to the States, it was like kind of nagging at me.
Yeah.
And then at some point I just decided that's what I was going to do. And then I moved back, or I moved here in 2015. So a year later.
What's Kurdistan versus Iraq, and why is it different, and what is it like being here?
Yeah. I mean, Kurdistan is the north. It's more or less the north of Iraq. And it's where the Kurds call home. It was a protected region starting in 1991.
This is the no-fly zone that Americans would have heard of.
Exactly.
It's basically U.S. Air superiority used to enforce, because Saddam was up here just like slaughtering Kurds wholesale.
Yeah, exactly. So
Kurds are Muslim.
Most Kurds are Muslim.
Most Kurds, we saw today. We saw,
but
some
Kurds are also spread over four countries. So there's Kurdish populations in Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria.
So it's
they're split by borders.
Yeah, it's an ethnic minority in all of those countries. And Iraq has had,
People often call them the largest ethnic minority without a home. I think that's disputed. It's kind of the classic saying, as well as with like Kurds have no friends but the mountains. People also claim that the largest minority without a home. So like,
right.
There is no Kurdish state. Kurdistan in northern Iraq is the closest thing that they've been to having a state, and it's still not a state. It's a autonomous region within Iraq. So you have three main cities. There's Duhok, Erbil, where we are, and there's Sulaymaniyah. And that is the area of the world where the Kurds have the most control over themselves and their politics and who governs them. And Kurds in Syria are slowly getting a little bit more control through the civil war there and with the fight against ISIS, but it kind of remains to be seen what's going to happen next. And Kurds in Turkey don't have really any control over their future with the fighting between the PKK and the Kurdish government, or yeah, the Turkish government, sorry.
They've got a boot on their neck. But it is one of the things that makes this area beguiling, at least to me, you know, from afar, is that this is a laboratory for what Kurdish autonomy could look like. Because you're right, as you were saying, it's easy to come to and easy to transit, you know, in and out of, because they control their own borders apart from the Iraqi state. So you can come in, specifically me, I could come in this week with an American passport, yeah, just get a stamp at the airport when I arrive. If I came into Baghdad, it would be a much different story. Like there's this weird sense of that they are part of Iraq, but definitely much more open for business than the rest of Iraq, and just different.
I mean, but they also try to separate from Iraq. They want to be different from Iraq. They want to be their own country. And they had a referendum in 2017, right after the battle against ISIS finished along their borders, where they tried to separate, and it failed massively. So they lost a bunch of territory that they were fighting over with Baghdad.
Well, the referendum won.
Yeah. Well, so yeah,
they voted yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And Baghdad said, "Oh no," right.
Yeah, and then
and took their richest city.
Yeah, and they took Kirkuk, which wasn't previously controlled by the Kurds. There's a large Kurdish population there, but the Kurds were able to take it when the Iraqi army ran away from ISIS in 2014. So they seized control of Kirkuk and held it until they had the referendum, and then at that point Baghdad was like, "Oh, we want that oil-rich city back."
Yeah, yeah.
And then they got it back. So there was like this big, more or less, bluster, if you look at like the past few years, by the Kurdish government here. They lost a lot of territory. They lost a lot of support by Kurds that, you know, wanted and hoped for a free country of their own through the referendum and through the lack of support from the international community for a Kurdish state of their own.
Yeah, we've seen this so many times, I think, with smaller countries, smaller ethnic groups. We were talking a lot today about Georgia, you know, a country that imagined that they had the international community at their back and a kind of a claim to autonomy regionally that was undeniable. And then, you know, the might of their larger neighbor just comes in and kind of crushes dreams. I mean, this is... and it's an interesting moment in Kurdistan, because that's kind of, you know, we're living in the aftermath of that, right? Where they had said, "We want to be free," and then they just got routed, and you're left in this thing. It was like, well, okay, well, how free can we be? Like, how Kurdish can we be? And it plays out. It's so fascinating, right? It plays out in all these different moments, from, you know, like a bar that will accept different ethnic groups or not, to, you know, just how people navigate religious differences, and like who's got the power, and generally you see people trying in a way that seems like very thoughtful to negotiate those things, and the atmosphere is very peaceful, but it's in a context that's got to be very difficult for Kurds right now.
There's like all these like weird, you know, complications between Kurdish identity and nationality and, you know, hopes for the future, and mixed in with like what it is to be an Iraqi, and all of these different things that are playing factors into, you know, emotions of the general public here, as well as like the corruption and the infighting between the parties and the massive wealth disparity between the poor and like the average Kurd and political and government officials, and, you know, fucking Ferraris driving down the street. And there's a lot of resentment in that. But then also you just had a referendum where the majority of the population voted to pull away from Iraq. And that was like the first time where, you know, average Kurds before that referendum I was talking to were like super excited. Like, we're going to do it. We're going to get our stay. And they had a lot of faith in the government to be able to pull that off. And to be able to pull away from Iraq, and all of that faith just like kind of blew up, and like immediately after, it was just kind of like devastating. Their government was unable to do it. Baghdad responded really strongly, and you know, what's it like to lose faith in this belief that you can have your own country when, you know, you really believe like you could? it's just like really sad in many ways. And lots of people I talked to were just like absolutely crushed. So like, what is it now? Like, what is it like now to be a Kurd? And like, wonder if you're able to ever able to get like ever able to have a state. And most people I talk to just don't think it's going to happen.
Right. Cause it wasn't just like, it's not like an ethno-nationalist dream, but it's also, they had done such a good job of removing themselves and being aloof from the severe crises that were happening in the rest of Iraq. Right. So they were building their economy. They were developing, they were really connected to the international community while the rest of Iraq was just on fire.
Yeah, and overnight, Baghdad was like, yeah, okay, cool. We're going to shut your airspace down. We're going to close your northern border. You're cut off. Like, and we're going to take back all this land. And just like the power that Baghdad asserted and was like able to prove that they still had just was so, so dominant. Like, they were just able to do so much, way more than like I think most Kurds were expecting.
Right, because they had been the model region, I guess, mm-hmm. for a long time after the invasion. How do you exist here as a journalist in trying to kind of keep up with that story? Because, you know, as with every journalist, you have kind of a dual purpose of trying to make a living, right? Particularly in those years when you were freelancing and living here in Erbil, and then also trying to tell deeper stories that are your own personal interests. Like, how do you take a camera and just go out in the street and say, like, I want to capture this moment in Kurdistan? I wouldn't even really know where to begin.
Yeah, I don't think I do at the moment. I don't think I ever have. But I think a lot of, you know, documenting a situation or documenting a group of people is just being there and being present and, you know, waiting for things to happen in front of you and just having your camera ready. And, you know, so being here for certain moments, I think are really important just to show the progression and show what happens over time. And I think like just going out one day, which is the problem with like journalism, is like go out one day and tell this whole story in 4 hours and then file by 5 o'clock. Like, you can't tell the whole story of what's going on for anybody in that amount of time, let alone like a country or a region or a war. And the beauty about like long-term things and being able to stay somewhere for a long time is like you're able to tell a deep story about what's going on here. And I don't think I've done that with Kurdistan. Like, I don't think I've done that with the war against ISIS, but I'm trying to, and I'm going to keep trying to. And like, hopefully in like 10 years, like I can look back and present this work to people that also lived through this. I'm just like, you know, is this accurate? Does this really show like what you experienced and what happened here? And I mean, I think for anybody who does this type of work, like that's the goal, is did I document this part of our entire existence to the fullest extent I could?
There's something that's very steady, and this is true for local journalists as well as foreign journalists, I think. It's like, it's very steady about the mission of journalism to kind of go into a place where chaos reigns, because, you know, we have been walking around the Citadel and the Central Plaza and people are taking selfies and they're memorializing a beautiful sunset on the first day of Ramadan. Like, they will have a record of these days, which are really good days, and their very worst days, they don't have a record of. They're just trying to survive. They're trying to get their shit. They're trying to find out where they can be safe. They're, you know, in absolute panic mode. And there is this thing of journalists like will go in and like from the outside, from some people's perspectives, it can seem a little ghoulish or something, but it's really to be the memory of these events as they happen, because these events will be politicized. The facts will be disputed, that the dates, the locations, the emotions, the reasons will all come under fire, but the photos are not going to lie, right? You were there. You saw it.
Well, I mean, I think that raises the question is like, is there a point for journalism, especially with, you know, everybody having a cell phone now and everybody recording almost everything they do? I mean, you saw it walking around today, like just everybody's recording almost everything they do. And I think journalism's at a point right now where we're all questioning, like, what is the point of us being here? And what is the point of me sticking my lens in some mother as she cries? Like, am I really adding anything to this when everybody else is also recording? And I think those are all questions like I ask myself, and I know my colleagues ask themselves quite often. The digital age has really changed, I think, what it means to be a journalist.
You're not the only one whose, you know, shutter is open. I mean, at any given moment, I think that's probably true. But, you know, if you go back to the very first episode of this podcast, you will hear that Mother Ayahuasca had said that it was very appropriate for journalists like myself earlier and like you these days to go and talk to people who had just lost someone. And she'd given like full permission to tell those stories. Yeah, because that's the main question that I always have, too. It's like, how weird is it to go into a conflict situation or a situation of grief and kind of start poking around, you know, dispassionately?
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
So tell me about Mosul and how you got involved in covering the battle to liberate Mosul.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to sum that up, really. So Mosul was held by ISIS since they rampaged across the region in 2014. So at that moment, like, the city was on lockdown and you couldn't access it. And in 2016, Iraqi forces started moving on Mosul. So I started living here in 2015. And in early 2016, there were like villages on the outskirts of Mosul that were being attacked by the Iraqi army. So I, you know, embedded with them, and I covered refugee, IDP, fleeing, like people, I covered people fleeing from those areas. And that was like the build up to Mosul. So from, I think it was March 2016 until the actual assault on the city started, which was October of 2016. And I try to cover it the best I could. And starting with the Peshmerga on the outskirts of the city in that first month, and then the Iraqi army hit the city from the eastern side the next month. So by November, the Iraqi army had reached the city outskirts. And, you know, I embedded with Iraqi army units. I embedded with medics. I spent a lot of time in you know, refugee groups where they were, like, collecting refugees and bringing them to camps. I spent a lot of time in camps talking to people about their experiences, you know, fleeing the war, getting bombed by U.S. aircrafts, and, like, living under ISIS. Like, all of that stuff, as well as, like, just the frontline, like, aspect of war. And I tried to, you know, do the best I could to document as much as I could about what was happening through that fight. And, you know, people thought it was going to wrap up. People were like, oh, this will be done by January. And then, you know, January rolls around and be like, oh, it'll be done by April. And like, April runs around. And eventually it finished in, mid-July of 2017. So it was 9 months and it was a lot of fucking people killed. And, you know, the AP did an investigation afterwards and, the estimate was like between 9,000 and 11,000 people were killed in nine months.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of civilians. There's a lot of Iraqi soldiers as well, but that was a lot of civilians. And yeah.
Not to mention the 4 years under ISIS. So I think, you know, when a lot of people in the United States and Europe would have heard about ISIS was around the time that they had swept through Mosul, because Mosul was a very important Iraqi city. And the fact that these, you know, kind of jihadi Salafis, like dead enders to use a Cheneyism, like had just been able to overpower a large Iraqi city and then occupy it for 4 years is astonishing.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, when did the West hear about ISIS? And what does the West care about ISIS? And the West doesn't, as far as like most people I talk to, like the West doesn't care about what happens to Iraqis. Like, they don't care about what happens to Syrians. Like, 9,000 Iraqis were killed trying to get Mosul back from ISIS. But, like, you talk to any American or, like, anybody in the UK, and, like, they don't know that. They think about, like, you know, what's ISIS able to do here? Like, what's ISIS able to do in, like, America or the UK? Or, like, do they bomb a church? So, I mean...
They don't think about what's happening here only in terms of, like, what could happen over in the States.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when, you know, you have an attack in the West, the sentiment is like, oh, like, they're here, like, they're still dangerous. Like, do you realize the lives that have been lost, you know, both in the fight to get ISIS back, but also, like, what ISIS did to people in Iraq and Syria? It's so much, so much graver. So many more lives have been lost. And not to compare, like, live numbers, but, like, if you really cared about ISIS, like, maybe you should, like, think about what they're doing to the local population and what their presence has done to the local population. And what we've done in, like, our name of defeating terrorism to the local population, which is massive airstrikes on entire cities and wiping them off the map.
Yeah, right. I mean, in that sense that it's kind of both things. Like, it actually does make a difference to what happens back home. But there's also the kind of global case of, like, these are people who have value. And oftentimes they are our allies, you know. So it's not even just, like, general, like, I love all humans value. But, like, these are actually people who we are here to protect and are supposed to be in a kind of deep relationship with. And they've been just... They've been suffering very deeply for things that we get real riled up about in the States, but don't have any actual experience with. And that, you know, it's eye-opening to kind of come here and see, like, what the actual, like, what's actually happening with, you know, the people you meet who have had direct experience with ISIS, which is pretty much just, like, the same as the boogeyman or the chupacabra in the United States, you know? It's like, we talk about ISIS. ISIS is not actually in the U.S., but a very relevant fight is being fought here by people who are our allies and who, you know, are part of this country that could be very successful and, you know, kind of a great model for the Middle East, even on our terms, even on American terms. You know, they could be a fantastic ally of ours if they didn't have to spend all this time just fighting and dying and living under the boot of this incredibly, like, just dark cloud, you know, that had come across. So I mean, when you started into Mosul, there was, as you said, there was a combination of, like, dealing with ITPs and trying to tell their stories and getting people who were coming out of the city, but also being on the front lines in a very real way. And, like, how do you calculate risk for yourself?
I don't have, like, an equation every time I go out. I think it, you know, it varies story by story. And, you know, assignment by assignment. But there's just, like, a really simple rule that I kind of put in place whenever, you know, I'm ever sharing a car with somebody or working with somebody else, which is, you know, if you don't feel safe, let me know and we're going to get out of here. And there's no, like, question about that. Like, if somebody says, that's my line, that's the line for the group, and then we all leave. And I've respected that from other people. Other people have respected that from me. And just those simple things of, like, you know, this is... We're working as a team here. Fixers, other journalists I'm with, writers, photographers, like, we're all looking out for each other, and we need to be to stay safe. And when one person says, like, you know, that's it, that's it, that's it for the group. And that's kind of been, like, the line. And you're able to gauge other things, like, through that work too. Like, you know, does he feel safe? Does she feel safe? Like, am I reading the situation to the best I can? And, you know, when you have more eyes, you have more ears, and you have more feelings out there, like, you're able to, I think, like, hopefully, calculate a little bit better. So if one person says no, that's it. I think it's kind of worked out so far. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you I think this cohort I hear and you know, up to not quite including some of the Iraqi colleagues and friends of yours who have, you know, as all Iraqis, but you know, particularly have lost people in this fight and journalists like Ahmed, who lost his brother, but generally in an era where we lost a lot of journalists and there's been something like 480 killed since 2003 in Iraq, it feels like, you know, this group has stayed safe.
There's certainly been people that have been injured. And, you know, I think in the larger community, we've lost people, not my immediate friends, but we've certainly lost some people that lived here. You know, a fixer was killed as well. That danger and that risk is very present. And I think it's important to just keep keep yourself aware of that as well. But man, I've made really fucking stupid decisions, and I've been extremely lucky, and I think I was lucky to also meet up with people who have been doing this before me and knew what they were doing and help pass that advice on. And I'm trying as much as I can to also pass that advice on to other people that are going to keep doing this. It's a small world, and we need to keep each other safe. We need to look out for each other. And people did that for me, and I'm going to keep doing it for other people. And I love this place, and I love my friends and my family here. And just to be able to shoot and just step away from that madness in New York for a second and just, you know, pull a camera back up to my face and just be myself for a little bit, and just relax and, you know, let life happen. And I'm able to do that in a strange way here.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of why I'm here too, is like I really realized that there was something very dissonant about what you were saying. It's like he's going there to, like, you know, kind of decompress and understand things, which of course something hugely necessary for me too. I was kind of like, there's that curiosity of like, what is it that he's got here, you know? And I feel like, you know, to kind of, not to put too fine a point on it, but like the road trip we had today was like a really nice, I don't know, it just felt like a really nice example of like what that actually is.
Just to backtrack for like a second, it's like if you've been like focusing on a thing for, you know, 5 years. So since like 2014, like I've been making trips here and then living here and then coming back and subsequent trips. It's like continuing a project is like super, super special. And like most people don't get to work on the same subject or the same subject matter for fucking 5 years.
Right.
It's it's just like, it feels natural to come back and keep shooting this thing I've been shooting. And it's a lot of fun. And I get to hang out with people I love. But yeah, so today we went up to a monastery in Shaklawa, which is also nicknamed Shakluja, because of the large Fallujan residents that have moved up there. But yeah,
the IDPs that have come up the mountains. And it's funny because Erbil is kind of an ugly city, you know.
Yeah, Erbil's a dust bowl, man. It's big suburbs, like high rise buildings that serve no purpose and are half empty and lots of money, and it's a weird place.
Yeah, I don't know what the equivalent is. There's some like little like kind of maybe boomtown vibes.
There's a wannabe Dubai vibe here.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right, which is not something you or I are gonna totally lock in on. But it's the capital. It's central, and what you had told me, which was actually true, is like just get out of the city a little bit, and you'll see what Kurdistan is actually like. They've had a lot of rain here, so the hills are super green. You're going up into the mountains, and the towns and villages get smaller and smaller. And Shaklawa is kind of a slightly kind of a resort community for people for whom the mountains speak very strongly, I think, you know. But there's just the small hike that we took was to a monastery, which is a fairly intense vertical, but you just go up into this.
Yeah, I mean, I was sweating.
Well, me too. But, you know, you go up into this crag in a mountain, and bones of the hermit that had lived there monastically until he just expired are kind of thrown behind a few rocks. And you've got these kind of grottos that have been turned to charcoal by all the soot from candles that have been lit by Christians. But it's also a Muslim holy place. And then when we went up there, it's like a family that arrived, started feeding us things.
Yeah, I mean, it's the hospitable nature of Iraqi culture is like shouldn't be underappreciated. Like, it's amazing. It's like, of course they were going to give us sweets and cookies that they baked. It's like, obviously. It's just like, you more or less like have to do that. And yeah, just started getting fed some chocolates and some pastries, and then hung out while they prayed.
Yeah,
I mean, for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, we were like three dudes. Your friend Rasul, who's like a Kurd from the mountains near the Iranian border, and you and me, and we showed up there. And I think in the States, people would be like, I was hoping to have a peaceful like experience in nature, or for these people, I was hoping to go and pray and just like be with the family and like, who are these people? You know, like, why are they here in my day? No, that's not it. They started feeding us, like, as you said, these homemade pastries and then chocolates. And then, you know, Rasul and I got trapped behind the prayer because they did what we calculated as something like 3,000 Hail Marys in Aramaic up in the, you know, kind of cave monastery up there.
Well, I mean, there's just like something really, really beautiful about Iraqi culture in general, which has always just like made me feel really, really warm, which is just like the hospitality and just gentleness with strangers. Just this family like walking up to meet us, like in the States, like no one ever would greet each other at a random like park situation where you're seeing something old. Like this family walked in with like, you know, 15 people, and we're ugly looking dudes, sweaty, hanging out like in a holy place. And immediately they were just like, hey, how are you doing? Like, let's hang out for a second. Like here's some cookies. And that thing happens all the fucking time. Like, people are just really, really nice. And just like not what Americans think of what Iraqis like normally do and what they're like. And it's always been just kind of a continual reminder for me of how like beautiful and special this country is. And like that like urge to try to share a little bit of that with Americans.
This is a tough job, you know, like you're dealing with financial instability as a freelancer, even as a staffer, you're dealing with, you know, personal risk, but I'm super glad that you're here doing it and like trying to make it happen. And in an effort to make that job harder, I'm going to finish with you the rest of this 800 milliliters of $5 blackjack whiskey.
We're not finishing that.
We're definitely going to finish it.
There's absolutely no way. We haven't eaten dinner and I'm really hungry. So we're not touching that. I'm going to have a little bit more, but
blackjack is going down tonight. Thank you, Genghis.
Thanks, man.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer for this episode. Taffy Mokunyadze was our consulting producer. Alexa Van Sickle is our online editor. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Genghis Yar, the journalist you heard in this episode, is the producer on this and all of our upcoming Iraq episodes. Next Thursday on this feed, also available for the first time without a subscription, Basima Abdulrahman, business owner, engineer, Kurdish woman. Her remarkable story says a lot about what this country is trying to become. We will meet you there.